Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 52. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we begin this week's episode, I'd like to give my heartfelt thanks to the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so very grateful for your encouragement and immense generosity. A full list of patrons is available on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. October's prize is a Tudor book bundle, kindly sponsored by the History Press. It contains three fabulous Tudor titles, Catherine Howard by Connor Byrne, Tudor Folk Tales by Dave Tong, and A History of the Tudors in 100 Objects by John Matusiak. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Arbella Stuart and Game of Queens is Sarah Griswood. Sarah is a best-selling Tudor biographer, novelist, broadcaster, a former film journalist, and commentator on royal affairs. She's written many excellent books, including Arbella, England's Lost Queen, Elizabeth and Leicester, Game of Queens, The Women Who Made 16th Century Europe, and Blood Sisters, The Women Behind the Wars of the Roses. Sarah is also the author of the historical novels, The Girl in the Mirror and The Queen's Mary. My conversation with Sarah straight after this musical break, courtesy of singer-songwriter Carlene. The song, No Master, is from Carlene's album entitled Elizabeth.
My mother lost her life for marriage. No, not I.
I will have one mistress
and no master.
I will have one mistress
and no master here.
Master here. Do you hear?
Welcome to Talking to You, Sarah. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
It's so lovely to have you on the show.
Nice to be here.
And I thought we could begin just by you introducing yourself to our listeners and just telling us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, well, I started out as a film journalist, which seems a bit of a journey to go to writing historical biographies. But as so often, it was one particular story that hooked me in, and that story was that of Arbella Stewart. That was my first historical biography. Since then, I've written several more, mostly but not all about the Tudor period. But like the rest of us, it is that century, the 16th century, that keeps on drawing me back in.
Absolutely. And was there something that sparked your interest in the 16th century and in Tudor history?
Well, I grew up in Kent, in southeast Kent, which is where I'm speaking to you now. And we're absolutely jam-packed full of history. I mean, I grew up outside Dover, and you really can't get a place that, you know, is more packed with English, with British history than that. So I grew up visiting National Trust houses, visiting places like Hever Castle, and also watching some of the great Tudor adaptations on the screen. So I suppose for me, yes, it's always been history. Yes, it's always been Elizabeth I, Anne Boleyn, and those around them.
And how lucky are you to live in that absolutely spectacular little corner of the world, you lucky duck. All right, so you've mentioned Arbella Stewart. Now, you've written an excellent biography of her. I'd love to know a little bit more about what drew you to her story in particular.
Right. Well, looking back, I can't believe how lucky I was to have hit on that story. I found it almost by chance. I was driving south from a friend's wedding, wanted to stop off somewhere. I'd never been to Hardwick Hall in Derbyshire, within sight of the M1 motorway. So I stopped and I was instantly hooked. I mean, I don't know how many of your listeners have been there, but anyone who gets the chance, go. It's spectacular. And although, of course, it's not really true to say that it's frozen in time, that it's, you know, sort of still encapsulates the way it was in the 16th century, you don't get many places that give you so strong a feeling. I was fascinated by the idea of how four women's stories hover around that house. Bess of Hardwick, of course, the great Tudor matriarch who built it, her granddaughter, Arbella Stewart, and the two queens, Elizabeth and Mary. Elizabeth I, Bess of Hardwick's, you know, monarch and friend, and Mary, Queen of Scots, who for many years was held prisoner but under the custody of Bess and her husband, the Earl of Shrewsbury. Now, Elizabeth I never visited Hardwick, and actually Mary was never there either because, you know, the timings weren't right. But nonetheless, those four women's stories just did speak to me from Hardwick. And of course, Mary and Elizabeth are very well known indeed. Many people have written about them, including me later. Bess of Hardwick, there'd been a wonderful biography by Mary Lovell. But Arbella, the more I began to look, I just could not believe that her story wasn't better known. Because when I looked into it, and the first thing I did was to get a volume of her letters that were put out by the Oxford University Press, I just couldn't believe it. It really was the story that had everything. I'm sorry, that was such a long answer.
No, that was a fabulous answer. I'm just sitting here thinking, oh, I love it. I can feel your enthusiasm for your subject,
well,
which is brilliant.
I could keep on going on because do you know Arbella's story?
Let's talk a little bit more about her story and her upbringing and her family. I'd love to know a bit more.
Well, she grew up largely at Hardwick and largely in the care of that all-powerful grandmother, Bess. But the crunch was about Arbella was her genealogy. She was Bess's granddaughter, but, you know, her mother was Bess's daughter, but her father was Lord Darnley's younger brother. And all of you knowing your Tudor history will know that that means that Arbella, through her father, had a claim to the English throne. Now, just how good a claim it is, you could argue about that. But arguably, she had a better claim than her cousin, James of Scotland, because the law of England said that no foreigner, and of course a Scotsman was a foreigner, could inherit land in England, never mind inheriting the land of England. And there really was a moment, the 1580s, a bit of the 1590s, when it really was believed that Arbella was going to inherit the throne from her kinswoman, Elizabeth I. And Elizabeth fostered that belief. You know, Arbella was a useful game in the great political chess game. She came to court as a young girl. Elizabeth told an ambassador's wife, look to her well, one day she will be even as I am, but I will have gone before. And the message seemed clear. Now, what went wrong? My feeling, I think the answer really is that Elizabeth lived too long, basically. It is possible that if Elizabeth had died in the 1580s, and, you know, given the lifespans of the day, that would not have been at all remarkable. She was already being written of as an old woman. Then just possibly Arbella would have got the throne, you know, as a possibly as a kind of puppet queen for some powerful noble. But who knows what would have come. But over the long years of the 1590s, support for Arbella dwindled away. She was being kept purposely away from London. She was being kept, you know, sort of in what came to her at least to feel a kind of imprisonment. And really, it just became apparent that there was no one who was really fighting her cause. When 1603 dawned, and it became clear that Elizabeth was at last dying, Arbella made her own push for the throne. She tried to ally herself in marriage to a Seymour, to a boy who had his, who she never even met, many years younger than she, but who had his own claim to the throne. The Privy Council were horrified when they heard Cecil. They sent a government hard man, basically, racing north to Hardwick to interrogate Arbella, to make sure that this was not going to go any further. And the letters she wrote then are quite extraordinary. I mean, her mental health began to crack under the pressure. One of the letters she wrote to Cecil, you know, I've seen it, and he wrote on the top of it, I think she hath some great vapour to her brain. And with the best will in the world, it's hard to disagree. I mean, one of these letters is 7,000 words long. Oh, yes, count. I know. And she was writing several a day. But we all know how that story ended. Arbella did not succeed in her bid. Her cousin James instead got the throne. And as Arbella's health recovered, he was coming south and sent word that Arbella could leave what she'd come to call this my prison, Hardwick, and could come to live at his court. So it looked fine and good for a few years, although Arbella was, you know, a bit of an outsider in that very ostentatious, frivolous games-playing court that grew up around Queen Anna, Anne of Denmark. But after a few years, Arbella realised that she still wasn't going anywhere. She was in her 30s, she was unmarried, and no one was ever, James was no more likely than Elizabeth had been ever to let her marry. So once again, she arranged her own marriage secretly and this time successfully. She married William Seymour, younger brother of the boy she tried for before. And so again, it was a boy, a young man this time, with his own claim to the throne. James was horrified when he found out. They were both thrust into prison. William into the Tower, Arbella into a kind of, you know, politer house custody. They staged this staggering double escape. I mean, you couldn't make it up. William, it was arranged, would sneak out of the Tower of London, disguised as his own barber, and get into a boat to take him, you know, down the river to join Arbella on a ship and sail abroad. Arbella fled her captivity, disguised as a man, rowed to the same ship. But it all went wrong. William missed the tide. So Arbella sailed on this ship into the channel, but he didn't. he wound up in Harwich, basically. But ironically, he did escape across the Channel in the end and spent a few years living in exile till after her death. Whereas Arbella, who within sight of the French coast, insisted that the ship should wait, that they should wait for William. James had sent warships after them. Arbella was captured, brought back to the Tower of London, where 5 years later she died insane. I mean, you couldn't make it up,
goodness,
could you?
What an extraordinary story that is. You know, and it's what I love about this period. There are so many brilliant stories that it's mind-boggling. And that's an amazing one, isn't it? Goodness.
Well, it is. The thing is, it's really got everything. On the one hand, it's got, you know, genuine political interest. My book was called Arbella, England's Lost Queen, which may be pushing it slightly, but they really were talking about her as not only a possible but a probable queen. And we've completely forgotten that. You know, history loses the losers. There were also those amazing letters. I mean, yes, they got a bit dotty in the end, but the ones that she wrote from Hardwick in the early months of 1603. But nonetheless, they're sort of self-exploratory and self-revelatory in a very unusual degree, very unusual for the time. And then you've got the sheer drama of the escape, the death. I mean, her last captivity in the Tower of London may very well have inspired the Duchess of Malfi, Webster's play. Again, to find those three things in one story is staggering. The only bad news, really, is that I found this for my first book and I didn't realise just how hard it would be to find anything else as amazing.
Oh, goodness. All right, Sarah, that's an incredible story. What I'd love to do now is talk a little bit about another one of your great books, which is called Game of Queens, The Women Who Made 16th Century Europe.
Right.
Yeah, now throughout history there have been many women who've wielded power, either directly or indirectly a lot of the time. What is it about female rule in the 16th century that piqued your interest and inspired this work?
Well, I first came to it, in fact, if I'm honest, I first came to it through a book that I read in my teens, maybe many of us did, Garrett Mattingly's Defeat of the Spanish Armada. Throwaway line in that book, he mentioned how throughout the 16th century, by chance, the religious divisions had often had a woman as their figurehead. You know, sort of Catherine of Aragon versus Anne Boleyn, as it were, Elizabeth versus the Marys. And looking at it, I began to think, gosh, that's true. And then I became interested in something else. There were mothers and daughters, or mentors and protégés. I began to see this kind of, I wish I could put it up on screen here, family tree, line of power, if you like. Lines of power going down through these women, through the sort of the long 16th century, the Tudor age. But it wasn't just England that interested me. What I became aware of was how many powerful women there were on the continent also. Now, some of them we know about. Catherine de' Medici is obviously a very well-known name, but others much, much less so. The ones who most struck and most interested me is Margaret of Austria, of whom many people would never have heard.
Okay, now before we delve even deeper, it would be really wonderful if you could set the scene for us a little bit. So how were female rulers viewed at the time, and what were some of the most prevalent beliefs surrounding female rule?
Right. Well, that's an interesting one, because on the one hand, of course, female rule, certainly in England, was viewed with some abhorrence as something, you know, unnatural that had to be explained away. One detail that rather fascinated me was that when Elizabeth I came to the throne, a lot of the Catholic writers, you know, and of course also people like John Knox, had been fulminating against female rule. I mean, when John Knox was writing, you know, Monstrous Regiment of Women and all that, but he was thinking, of course, of people like Mary Tudor in England and Mary de Guise ruling as regent in Scotland. And suddenly, when Elizabeth was there, they all had to change their tune. But I know, in John Knox was far from the only one. What I rather love, to quote one, and to quote, you know, one very close to Elizabeth, he had to write that it was all okay because Elizabeth was an exceptional woman, that while most women were, I quote, doltified with the dregs of the devil's dunghill, she was quite different. I know, she was quite different. She was okay. But you see, on the continent, what you saw time and time again was women ruling not necessarily in their own right. Isabella of Castile, of course, did rule in her own right. But in France and in the Netherlands, you saw women acting as regents. France, where there was the Salic law in place, you know, or the Salic custom, it really was more than actual law. But so women couldn't rule, couldn't even pass on the right to rule, but they could and did repeatedly act as regents for absent husbands, sons, for children. And then the Habsburg Empire, when the territories in the Iberian Peninsula in Spain and up in the Netherlands came to come together, you know, under one rule, time and again, the Habsburgs used women as regents. They were regarded as a safe pair of hands in the way that perhaps another, a rival man, might not have been. So you saw Margaret of Austria, who ruled the Netherlands as regent for her nephew, the young Charles V, and who sat down with her old playmate, Louise of Savoy, who was, you know, acting as power behind the scenes in France, to negotiate the so-called Ladies' Peace of Cambrai. And Margaret of Austria was succeeded as regent by her niece, who was succeeded as regent by her niece. So again, it's this kind of chain of power. You know, it was okay for women to be regents. Perhaps the question of them actually sitting on a throne was deeply controversial, not least perhaps because of that almost religious, almost sacred element about it. But nonetheless, as we know, the century saw a number of women pull it off, and Elizabeth I with quite staggering success.
Absolutely. Now, so they could rule in their own right. They could be a consort, of course, to a king. They could act as regent. Is there any other way that they could influence and wield power at the time?
Yes. Well, I think the big word there, you're right, is influence. Of course, in a way, what we're never going to know for certain is what influence, soft power, if you like, was wielded by the women who didn't even have a title. I mean, perhaps let's take Louise of Savoy, for example. You know, her son, Francois, was still a very young man, more interested in hunting and hawking when he came to the throne. And everyone agreed that Louise was the power behind the throne. But soft power, the power of a wife, for example. I mean, aren't we all still all arguing about exactly where and how Anne Boleyn exercised influence over Henry?
So, Sarah, you've probably mentioned quite a few of the women that you've talked about in your book or that you've written about. Are there some others that you'd like to mention that you've featured in your book?
Well, of Game of Queens, well, I'm going to put in an absolute special pitch for Margaret of Austria. Yes. I said regent, but that sounds a little boring. But she was a fascinating character. She was sent off as a very young child, meant to be married to the Dauphin of France. That fell through when he took the throne and basically, you know, went for a bigger heiress instead. She then sailed to Spain to marry the son of Ferdinand and Isabella, and her ship almost went down in the Bay of Biscay. And apparently, while all those around her were terrified and, you know, clinging to the masts and things, she composed a mocking, rhyming epitaph for herself. Here lies Margaret, the willing bride, thrice married, yet a virgin when she died. And I mean, any girl who can do that under those circumstances gets my vote. She had already officially, you know, been proxy married. But her personality was amazing also. She was this very cultured, if you read her letters, she's the one you'd want to be marooned on a desert island with. And she was also, which fascinated me, first mistress to Anne Boleyn.
That's right.
We all know that Anne Boleyn spent many years at the French court, but before that, she spent more than a year at the court of Margaret of Austria, and I can't believe she didn't learn some lessons there.
Oh, I think she absolutely learned many lessons there. That's so true. I was just thinking while you were talking that at the end of Eric Ives' biography of Anne Boleyn, he's talking about how remarkable Anne was, but he does say in a century that had many remarkable women and many women of note. So, you know, I love that you've written about this because it sounds like there are some really intriguing characters there and some lesser known ones as well.
Yes, well, there are. I mean, heaven knows there are, you know, there are other women like Mary of Hungary, Margaret of Austria's niece. But one thing that fascinated me was the degree to which certainly we in England, but I suspect in, you know, the whole English-speaking world, aren't altogether aware of them. Because we tend, I think, to be quite Anglo-centric in our history. It's slightly, if they weren't obliging enough to write their letters, whatever, you know, memos, in English, we kind of don't know about them. And that actually gives us a skewed perception on the 16th century, 15th century medieval ages, when of course they were far more aware of Europe, of links across nations, than we are. And one thing that fascinated me was that you could see, I think, this sense of sisterhood among ruling, among powerful women, really sometimes, you know, going, cutting across the borders of countries and sometimes going against the interests of, you know, the men they were married to. There really was, I know sisterhood is a modern word and one should be, you know, slow to impose it on a time hundreds of years ago. But nonetheless, whether or not the word is, I think the concept was there.
Yes, and are you able to give us any, is there any example that comes to mind to kind of illustrate that sisterhood was happening?
Yes, there is. At that very moment when Margaret of Austria and Louise of Savoy were sitting down to negotiate the ladies' peace on behalf of the Habsburgs on one side and the King of France on the other, Margaret of Austria was also being asked by her former sister-in-law, Catherine of Aragon, to help her find lawyers to fight her divorce, her annulment case against Henry. So Margaret was taking time out from these important negotiations to, yes, find good lawyers to help the Queen of England combat her husband. And years later, when Catherine's daughter, Mary Tudor, was, she believed, in real danger of her life, you know, in the reigns of her father and then her brother, Mary of Hungary had warships waiting off the English coast to try and sweep Mary Tudor abroad if necessary.
Do you know, Sarah, it's fascinating that you bring that up, because that's something I've only learnt recently. I've been looking at some documents from 1535 and 1536, and I was quite surprised to hear that there was a lot of talk about whisking Mary away, and I hadn't really heard that before, so I thought that was really interesting.
I know, me too. That's kind of the big adventure story that got away.
Yes, that's
it?
Right.
I mean, imagine exactly the movie that would have made.
That's so true. It's so many incredible stories. Now, you've studied the lives of many powerful and influential 16th century women. What qualities do you think they shared, and what can we as women, modern women, learn from them today?
I think there is a certain amount we can learn about them. And indeed, in a sense, we can learn as much from the failures as from the successes. I think sisterhood is one lesson, but I think also flexibility, a kind of pliability. With some of them, the ones, the behind the scenes ones, it's what, I don't know if you, Nurse Cavell, you know, the English heroine of the one who, you know, the wartime martyr.
Yes.
She famously said, it's amazing what you can get done if you don't mind who gets the credit. And a lot of these women exercised power that way. But of course, others didn't. I mean, heaven knows, no one took credit away from Elizabeth I. I'd say what we can learn from her, and perhaps from some of her predecessors, you know, in power, people like Isabella of Castile, is the need to find a language of power. that works for you. I mean, much has been written about the iconography, the imagery that Elizabeth I used. You know, the way she found a way to kind of cloak, to kind of present her controversial female monarchy. And one of the things that most interested me when I was researching Game of Queens was a book written by Anne de Beaujour, who we haven't mentioned yet, who was one of the earliest women in my story, who ruled France for many years effectively as quasi-regent for her younger brother. And she actually wrote a manual of advice for powerful women, Lessons to My Daughter. And she describes a good many of the techniques that I think, you know, some might recognise today.
Oh, that sounds intriguing. Is that available for people to read online, or do you need a hard copy of that?
Online, I don't know. I think it may well be. I have to admit, I got my hard copy from the musty shelves of the London Library. But no, I think it may very well be online as well.
That sounds quite interesting. I like the sound of that. All right, thank you so much. Now, I was very excited to find out that you are working on a new Tudor book. Can you tell us about that one?
I am. Well, it really comes back, in a sense, to what I've just said about finding a language of power. It's called Tudors in Love. It is about my theory that the Tudors were a dynasty in love with the idea of love. But what I really want to look at is this centuries-old ideal of courtly love, which has long fascinated me. I first came across it, as so many of us probably did, reading romantic stories about Arthur and Guinevere, for example, as, of course, did so many from the 12th century onwards. Courtly love was an ideal, a kind of huge collective fantasy that was born in the Middle Ages, but it had a huge resurgence in the 15th century, and I would say in the hands of the Tudors in 16th century England. I'd also say, mind you, that it still influences much of our behaviour today. But you can see how that played out in the romance of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. And you can see, too, how Elizabeth I used it, put a spun on it, if you like. And this is really where all of those things about her courtiers, you know, treating her like a goddess come to earth, this idea the Queen can do no wrong, men like Robert Dudley, Leicester, and so many others, you know, in the court in this kind of posture of devotion towards her. Because this was what courtly love, in theory, demanded. Now, obviously, it didn't always have a great deal to do with the actual realities of the lives of medieval women. But nonetheless, a fantasy can be an immensely powerful thing. I think this ghost absolutely haunted the Tudors, though I also feel that they actually made use of it, and I still feel it haunts us today.
Fascinating. And I've actually been reading about it at the moment, and all the kind of rules, I suppose you can say. Obviously, if you were going to be at court at the time, you would have had to have learned these conventions.
Well, I think probably by the Tudor age, they had been, you know, internalized to some degree.
Right, okay.
But certainly in the earlier years, there were actual manuals. And there's a great deal of debate, you know, to the degree to which these manuals, like by a man called Andreas the Chaplain, Andreas Capellanus, yes, at the court of Marie de Champagne, Elizabeth, you know, Eleanor of Aquitaine's daughter. And he actually laid down the precise rules. And The extraordinary thing is when you start to look at the comportment of, say, Anne Boleyn and Henry, it all, you know, just how many points there are at which the rules hit what they were doing and effectively how they went wrong. I mean, this book may well have been written with an element of tongue in cheek, but nonetheless, it courtly love, the whole chivalric ideal, got picked up again very seriously in the 15th century. And I'd say that it's an ideal which on the one hand seems to offer women a lot of power. You know, the lover, you have Lancelot in the old, the true courtly love stories, Lancelot, you know, not only kneeling at Guinevere's feet, but finding a comb she's dropped on the highway, and adoring the hairs that are caught in it. And, you know, our reaction now would be, frankly, that he should get professional help, you know, quickly. But although in theory this had a sort of woman on a pedestal being adored, there were a huge number of traps there. And I'd argue that Anne Boleyn found some.
And when can we expect this book?
Well, I'm only just writing it.
Oh, beginning just...
it now, I'm afraid. So we're talking 2 years away. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. We don't want to put any pressure on you. We'll wait patiently. That's fine. Sarah, how wonderful to chat with you. Now, we're at that time of the episode where I like to play what I call a little game of 10 to go. So these are just questions to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready to do that?
Okay.
Number one. What is a favourite holiday destination for you?
Well, almost every year I've gone to Venice. Now, I go for a particular reason, for the Venice Film Festival. My husband's a film critic, but I guess Venice has to be there number one. And of course, for anyone in love with the 16th century, it's not too hard to go there yearly.
What are you currently reading?
Oh, I have a nasty habit of rereading rereading old classic detective stories. And I think it's Marjorie Allingham currently on my bedside table.
And a favourite childhood memory?
Going to a historic house near us. But if I'm honest, what flashed into my head first wasn't the house and the history. It was the quince jelly on scones in the tea room.
That sounds really like a great childhood memory. What is a skill that you'd like to learn?
Putting eyeliner on correctly or sewing at least to a pitch where I didn't have to attach buttons with a safety pin. Oh, no, sorry. There's more and more.
There's more.
actually getting a tiny bit less tech unfriendly so that I don't have to sit up half the night before a Skype call trying to work out how to use the damn thing.
And I do like the eyeliner one. I'm a bit hit and miss with that. Some days pretty good, other days not so good. What is your go-to comfort food?
Pasta. I spent a year in Italy between school and university, so I feel an honorary Italian, as it were. And yeah, pasta.
Okay, and what do you like to do to unwind and relax?
Walk the dog, the Labrador, curl up in bed, basically. Sorry.
No, that's I know you do a lot, so that's absolutely fine. And now you touched on this earlier when you introduced yourself, but what's something that you love about where you live?
Well, if you could see it, you'd know. I'm sitting in my study. It is an old house, but all around it, we're surrounded by garden with these gigantic 100-year-old trees. I love the part of the world because I'm very near to the Kent coast. I'm outside Deal, which is, you know, quite near to Dover, and which indeed, I mean, you know, Julius Caesar landed there. Perkin Warbeck tried to land there. You know, it's got itself. Henry VIII built a fort there.
Wow.
But the house and garden within this setting. I mean, I grew up walking dogs on the White Cliffs of Dover. As a child, a very young child, I was lucky enough, won't tell you the whole story, but I met our former Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, on the cliffs. I was far too young to know who he was, but he spoke to my mother. He was making some sort of a visit there. He looked down into the water of Dover Harbour and he said, "That's liquid history."
Oh,
and
wow.
I always remember that. I mean, he was right. It's true. But so I love being, I guess, our house and our garden, but within this massively historic context.
And I love that quote. That's liquid history. That's brilliant. What was the last film that you watched?
That's quite relevant too. It all keeps on coming back to history, doesn't it?
It does.
The last film that I watched was The King, starring Timothée Chalamet, but based, well, freely adapted, as they say, and they're not kidding when they say freely, from Shakespeare's history plays, from Henry V, basically.
And what music do you enjoy listening to?
No, I don't listen to a huge amount, except for Adele on practically continuous loop. but I'm quite besotted by the Sound of Silence, really, so I'm not someone who plays music when I work. not even Elizabethan music.
No, yeah, I can't. I know people that play music and write at the same time, and I can't do that myself. No.
Yes.
All right, lucky last. What's something that you'd like to see more of in the world?
Oh, that's like those questions where they ask beauty queens and they all have to say world peace. World peace or Labradors? Actually, no, I'm sorry. I mean, the really true answer at the moment, there is only one, isn't there? It's a bit more awareness of the necessity of conservation, awareness of ecological needs and so on. But that is rather a serious, grim answer. Sorry, we can go back to Labradors if you like.
We've got Labradors there to fall back on if we need, but no, that's all right. Now, the very, very last thing before I let you run away and do some work is the Tudor takeaway. So I always ask my guests for a Tudor takeaway, something for our listeners to go off and explore after this episode. So do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
Well, because I am such a Luddite and so tech unfriendly, I'm not going to go for, a blog, although NB, that it's wonderful just how many historical documents are currently being digitized by, for example, the British National Archives. Have a look there. In fact, that's what I really should say. But otherwise, I'd say if ever you're looking for, a good something to watch on a wet afternoon, and by any chance you haven't seen these, go back to the old television or film starring Glenda Jackson as Elizabeth I, and or the less well-known, much more recent two television plays with Helen Mirren in the same role. Because to me, both those women really nail Elizabeth's nature, and they tell us a lot about queenship.
So thank you so much, Sarah, and I so appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to talk Tudors with me. I really look forward to hearing more updates on your new book as well, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.